It is Thursday, July 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump says NATO allies have made new defense spending commitments. We look at Iran's presence in Syria.
In the last 6 months, there have been a bevy of these military encounters between Israel and the Syrian government and Iran.
And singer Selena Gomez releases a new single following recent personal struggles. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump declared victory Thursday at the conclusion of the NATO summit, saying he had won commitments from other countries to increase their defense spending.
Everyone's agreed to substantially up their commitment. They're going to up it at levels that they've never thought of before.
The U.S. leader gave no specifics on which countries had agreed to increase defense spending.
But since last year, they've raised an additional $33 billion that's been put up by the various countries, not including the United States. And the United States commitment to NATO is very strong, remains very strong.
NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said there was a new sense of urgency to increase military funding, and he credited Trump with having an impact. Reporter Henry Richwell at the NATO summit in Brussels tells me what's known about the spending commitments from NATO members.
There's very little detail, really, to add to the rhetoric of that increased commitment. As you say, Donald Trump told reporters here in his final press conference that he had secured a victory of sorts, that he had convinced allies through his own unique brand of diplomacy, really, that they had to increase defense spending and increase it much more quickly. Currently, the NATO target is 2% of GDP by the year 2024. And it's not clear whether any of Donald Trump's NATO allies agreed to increase spending at any quicker rate. Of course, his other NATO allies were asked that very question in their press conferences that followed, and none of them admitted or said put forward any concrete proposals that they would increase spending further. They simply spoke of the need for a continuing dialogue, the need to continue to make efforts towards NATO and towards defense spending. But certainly there are no declarations from NATO or declarations from other member states of any concrete commitments to any greater defense spending. So it's very difficult at the moment to see how Donald Trump's rhetoric about being able to secure these commitments are being matched by political reality.
Because I think Mr. Trump had indicated the day before that he was going to urge NATO allies commit to spending 4% of their gross domestic product as opposed to the 2% that he wanted.
That's right. He's been pushing for a much harder, a much faster increase in defense spending among all allies. And, well, the state of affairs at the moment is that several allies are struggling to meet the 2% target. Germany, for example, the second richest country in NATO, spends just over 1%, and its current strategy is to increase spending only very gently to 1.5% by the year 2025. So you get an idea of the scale of difference between what Donald Trump wants and what he's demanding and what European allies are really doing in reality. There's only 8 NATO countries this year who are on target to achieve that 2% of GDP target that you mentioned. So that leaves another 21 who will miss that target. But there is one thing that everyone here is agreed on in Brussels, even those who perhaps aren't the closest allies of Donald Trump, is that he has changed the game here. He has got far more countries to commit to increase their spending. The details perhaps are to be worked out another day, but the summit has focused very much on defense spending, and there are many more commitments that perhaps wouldn't otherwise be there if he weren't here in place.
Trump said at the end of the summit that he said before, we should say, he was a critic of NATO, almost indicating it was sort of past its usefulness. But he closed the summit saying that he believes in NATO. And he said the U.S. commitment to NATO remains very strong.
That's right, and I think we've seen a repeat of this dual-track diplomacy, if you will, of Donald Trump. One thing he says to a domestic audience back home, and he writes on his Twitter feed, perhaps differs markedly from what he says in the bilateral meetings and in the press conferences and when he's among allies here. There has been criticism of that, of course, from many quarters, but his supporters and the president himself justifies it on the basis of his results. And he very much here claimed that those results are self-evident, that NATO members are increasing their defense spending much more quickly.
Henry Ridgewell reporting from Brussels. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. President Trump says Russian President Vladimir Putin is neither friend nor foe. Turkey's economic policy stokes a currency crisis. President Trump releases a text of a letter from North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. And former Pakistan Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif is set to return to Pakistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists say that for about the first 2.1 billion years of Earth's history, there wasn't enough oxygen in its atmosphere to support complex life. Then about 2.5 billion years ago, blue green algae called cyanobacteria, living in Earth's shallow oceans, began emitting enough oxygen through photosynthesis to create the permanently oxygenated atmosphere that keeps us alive today. A new study led by researchers at the University of Washington suggests that Earth did get a couple of whiffs of oxygen when levels of the gas rose and fell at least two times, some 50 to 150 million years earlier. The researchers were able to determine this after finding certain elements that are dependent on an oxygenated environment in samples of sedimentary rocks taken from deep underground in Australia. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, there's been a sharp fall in the number of migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea into Europe. We'll have a report. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu met this week in Moscow with Russian President Vladimir Putin. It's the latest in a series of meetings centered around Iran's presence in Syria. It's an issue expected to be discussed at Monday's U.S.-Russia summit in Finland. Netanyahu said every visit is an opportunity to act with Russia and try to stabilize the situation in the region. He repeated that Iran needs to leave Syria. Israel has been on heightened alert since pro-regime forces backed by Russia advanced into rebel-held southwest Syria near the Israeli and Jordanian frontier. Israeli missile and airstrikes have hit both Syrian and Iranian targets in recent weeks. Thursday, Israel attacked three Syrian positions after an unarmed drone violated its airspace. David Lesh is a regional expert and history professor at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He tells International Edition's Victor Beatty the Iranian presence in Syria is potentially the most worrisome development of the long, tragic Syrian civil war.
The many sides to the war in Syria have recognized this, particularly Israel and Russia and also Iran. And in the last 6 months, there have been a bevy of these military encounters between Israel and the Syrian government and Iran. And so Russia is being acknowledged clearly as the main power broker in Syria, is the go-to country in terms of trying to settle this down. And Russia is playing the role the U.S. used to play, actually, in the region, in that it has relationships with parties to the conflict or potential conflict, in this case, the Syrian government, Iran, and Israel. And Netanyahu has met with Putin on a number of occasions, primarily to make sure that Israeli aircraft doesn't bomb Russian positions or vice versa. But now they're focused on trying to get Iran away from the border of Israel. And although I don't think Israel or Russia will be able to certainly get close to eliminating the pervasive Iranian presence in Syria, I think they will be successful in moving them off the border and kind of restoring the status quo ante, which it was before beginning of the Civil War, when there were Syrian troops on one side of the Golan Heights and UN forces in the middle and Israeli troops on the other side.
Daraa, of course, the seat of the rebellion that erupted some 7 years ago in Syria. Now that the city itself has been encircled, is the rebellion in Syria effectively over?
It's in disarray, and they're certainly on the retreat, and it's very much a symbolic victory if the Assad government were to take Daraa again, because, as you said, that's where the uprising began. It's also important in terms of securing its border on the Golan Heights, and more particularly with Jordan, so that it can, engage in the productive trade it had with Jordan prior to the civil war. But there still is the province of Idlib in the northwest that's become kind of the preserve of remaining opposition groups, and where many opposition fighters have been bussed by the Syrian regime after these reconciliation agreements, which is apparently what's also happening now in the southern front. Many of the fighters are being bussed up to Idlib. After the government takes over the south, as it seems perched to do, no doubt they will start to move on Idlib, which becomes a little bit more complicated because the Turks are entrenched up there, plus a number of pro-Turkish groups, and plus the Turks don't want, you know, an exodus of refugees entering Turkey again. They're trying to return many Syrian refugees back to Syria. So that's a much more complicated situation for Russia as well, because they don't want to be in the middle of a firestorm between Syria and Turkey. So that has to be very delicately handled in a diplomatic way. And how the Syrian regime will regain its control in that area, I think, will be more of a diplomatic rather than military accomplishment.
David Lesh said the compromise that seems to be emerging among Russia, Israel, and the Gulf states is the willingness to accept the continuation of the regime of Bashar al-Assad, but with the understanding that Damascus distances itself from Tehran. The UN Migration Agency reports a steep decline in the number of migrants and asylum seekers making the perilous sea journey across the Mediterranean into Europe this year. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the agency's headquarters in Geneva.
So far this year, the International Organization for Migration reports more than 47,600 migrants and asylum seekers have entered Europe by sea. This is fewer than half the number that arrived over the same period last year, and less than one-fifth the number of arrivals over the same time frame in 2016. IOM notes the number of deaths at sea over the past 6 months also has declined, though it has been climbing recently. IOM spokesman Joel Millman says 493 people have been confirmed missing or dead over the last 3 weeks, indicating how treacherous the Mediterranean crossing can be.
And that accounts for about a third of all the deaths in the region this year, which now are approaching 1,500. We had months in the last 4 years, I count eight of them, we were averaging close to 1,000 deaths a month. So 493 in 3 weeks is certainly important, but nonetheless, it's a far cry from when shipwrecks were being reported almost daily, which was a few years ago.
Millman says the number of migrant arrivals in Italy is slowing significantly. He says new figures show Spain is on the verge of becoming the busiest passageway from Africa into Europe. He says roughly 200 people a day are entering Spain irregularly from North Africa, with a heightened number of deaths and missing on that route. The UN Migration Agency says the hysteria surrounding the so-called migration crisis in Europe is blown out of proportion. It says numbers do not lie. And the numbers indicate Europe is going through a political crisis and not a migrant crisis. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
With visiting football fans largely praising Russia for a warm welcome amid World Cup 2018, the plight of a professional footballer turned refugee from Ivory Coast presents a more complicated picture. Charles Maines has the story from Moscow.
With Russia hosting World Cup 2018, global football fans are giving their Russian host high marks for hospitality.
Yeah, we have no problem at all so far. So we can walk in the streets, very safe.
For me, very good country. Russian are very positive people.
As for the warnings about racism in the stands and aggressive police behavior, overblown, say many.
I saw that they are so respectful.
I think that Russia have changed.
But visiting Russia is one thing, staying in Russia sometimes another. Kajale Traore arrived in Russia 6 years ago, forced to leave a football career after violence flared up in his native Ivory Coast following contested presidential elections in 2011.
I am a Muslim and I was playing football. The new president who came into office promised to treat both Muslims and Christians equally. But when one heard a Muslim name, I started having many problems.
At a recent event hosted by the FIFA-supported World Cup Diversity House, Traore told audience members how he fled to Russia in 2012 and how he's now fighting to legalize his status as a refugee.
I was told that Russia cannot issue a visa for me and I have to go back home. Why should I go back home? Why? I have a family here. They are Russian.
Now married to his Russian wife, Diana, and with a 2-year-old son, Traore's visa limbo has left him at the mercy of constant harassment by police and employers who have sometimes cheated him out of his wages due to his lack of documentation.
We thought marriage might simplify things. It has not simplified anything.
Kajule Traore's case has been taken up by Civic Assistance, a Russian NGO that advocates for refugee rights. The group's director, Svetlana Ganushkina, says that Traore's bid for refugee status faces near impossible odds because of government policies that ignore Russia's international obligations to displaced peoples.
It's not just a typical story. It's a story that applies to nearly everyone who seeks refugee status. In all of the entire of Russia, just 585 people have been given refugee status.
In this World Cup, the Russian squad had a remarkable run, defying the odds to reach the quarterfinals for the first time in the country's history. Traore is among those rooting Russia on, but with dreams of defying his own odds.
When the judge issues me documents, I hope to join a great club.
It is a long shot, Traore knows, but he continues to train every day, hoping that come next World Cup, he'll be wearing a Russian jersey and scoring for his adopted home. Charles Maines for VOA News, Moscow.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our 5-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is International Edition. A new single is out by a performer who struggled with health and personal problems recently. VOA's Border Crossing host Larry London joins me with the latest.
Well, today, Sarah, we're going to talk about Selena Gomez. Selena Gomez has won 16 Teen Choice Awards, an ALMA Award, an American Music Award, MTV Video Music Award, People's Choice, and 2 Billboard Women in Music Awards. She sold over 7 million albums, 22 million singles so far in her 5-album career, which began in 2009. And now she has a brand new song, which we're going to play for you right now. Here's Selena Gomez, Back to You.
Took you like a shot, thought that I could chase you with a cold evening. Let a couple years water down how I'm feeling about you. And every time we talk, every single word builds up to this moment. And I gotta convince myself I don't want it even though I do. You could break my heart in two, but when it heals it beats for you.
Now, hasn't Selena Gomez had some health problems recently?
Yes, as a matter of fact, it's been widely publicized that she has dealt with lupus for a number of years. She's the Lupus Foundation celebrity spokesperson, and she's been battling lupus, and it's something that even caused her kidney failure. And last September 2017, she received a kidney transplant from her best friend, actress Francia Reza. And Selena said that actually the kidney transplant saved her life. People didn't realize how dire the situation was for her. But the lupus, which is an autoimmune type degenerative disease, there is no cure for it. You just have to keep on going through a lifetime of antibiotics and treatment. it took its toll on her kidneys. So she's doing much better, feeling much better. But, you know, over the years, she's had mental health issues. She's canceled tours a number of times. Of course, everybody knows about her much publicized relationship with Justin Bieber. And these days, her handlers, the people close to her, her friends, are trying to shield her from all of the publicity about Justin Bieber's pending engagement to Hailey Baldwin. They got engaged after only a few weeks. So a lot of people think, wow, this is probably going to hurt Selena, given her investment into that relationship. But her friends have kept her in the clear of the news tabloid fodder that's been going on. But Selena Gomez keeps herself very busy. She's a UNICEF ambassador, and she also is designing Coach handbags. She got paid $10 million to be the face of Coach.
Not bad.
When asked if she's going to come out with a new album or a tour, she's very reluctant to commit to that. She's been putting out singles. She put out Bad Liar and a couple of other songs as well over the last year, but there's no indication that she actually has plans for an album. She is promoting the new film that she's in that opens this weekend called Hotel Transylvania 3. It's an animated film. She stars opposite Adam Sandler. Her character is Mavis, and she's going to be a voice character in another film coming out in 2019 as well. So she's keeping herself very busy. It looks like there's no sign of her letting up. She's producing a TV show called 13 Reasons Why. She's just signed with Netflix for a third season, so there's a lot of great things coming out. In fact, the new song, which we heard Back to You, is off the soundtrack to 13 Reasons Why Season 2. So Selena Gomez is definitely one of the A-listers, and she remains a very hot property.
All right, thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings. And the music of Selena Gomez brings an end to our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The Russian government continues to stifle press freedom and media independence. The U.S., said State Department spokesperson Heather Nauert, condemns the selective targeting of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, or RFERL, and Voice of America, or VOA, under Russia's law of foreign agent media outlets. RFERL and VOA remain the only media outlets designated under this law, which exacerbates long-standing restrictions on their distribution in Russia. Moreover, on July 3rd, the State Duma took another step toward approving legislation that would extend the foreign agent designation from media outlets to individual persons taking part in the creation of materials for media outlets. This bill, warned Ms. Nauert, could provide the Russian government a new tool to target independent journalists and bloggers in retaliation for their work. John Lansing, the CEO and director of the Broadcasting Board of Governors, expressed grave concern over the attack on RFERL and VOA. The new Russian law, he said, is clearly a political attack on an influential U.S. institution and an attempt to discredit the accurate, reliable news we provide to Russian audiences every day. Moreover, he said, this law wrongfully stigmatizes our journalists and puts them at risk. The United States again calls on the Russian government to uphold its commitments under the Helsinki Final Act and its obligations under the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights to respect the exercise of fundamental freedoms, including freedom of expression, in Russia. The targeted campaign against RFERL and VOA is worrying and unacceptable, declared Mr. Lansing. But it will not deter us from our mission to inform and engage people in Russia and around the world in support of freedom and democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at www.voanews.com/editorials.